Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is The Compliance Guide.
The Compliance Guide.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is The Compliance Guide. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
Looking forward to this discussion. And, you know, for me, this is one that hits home on a number of personal levels. And I think as you listen to my guest explain her positions on certain treatment aspects of cancer and entrepreneurialism and things that we're going to explore today, I think you're going to have an opportunity to reflect on how you look at these situations and how you can better be equipped to help your loved ones, your friends, your colleagues who are given not so great news at some point in their life. So with that said, it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Katie Deming to the program. Katie, how are you?
I'm great, Sean. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So I know you're up there in the Pacific Northwest. You're in Portland, Oregon.
That's correct.
Yeah, I love Portland. My wife and I actually spent a little time up there about a year ago. We went to, is it Swan Lake that's up there?
Oh, Swan Island.
Swan Island. So my wife is a grower of dahlias. And actually, that's the largest dahlia farm, if I'm not mistaken, in the North America.
Yeah. So right now, that's pumpkin season out there, and they have like amazing pumpkin patches where I always take my girls every year. So absolutely, I love Swan Island.
Wonderful. So a little bit about Dr. Deming. You know, she is a graduate of Duke University, and I'm going from my memory here. So if I misstep on something, you let me know. She's a graduate of Duke University, where she got her doctorate. She was also the chief of oncology medicine, and she decided at some point in her career not too long ago that as a radiation oncologist, she needed to reprioritize. She wanted to step away and kind of reassess where she's at. And it was interesting, you know, because it led to some significant life changes. And in following her story, as I have been now for probably about the last 4 or 5 days and trying to prepare for our conversation today, it's really spectacular to kind of see the trajectory that her professional life and her personal life are now on. And with that said, you know, let's talk a little bit about your TED Talk. And I think that's the first place I wanted to really explore with you. And it was basically, how do we talk to somebody with cancer?
Yeah. So my TED Talk was in May of 2021, and I had, this came from a experience that I had around when I was in leadership. So I, in addition to being a radiation oncologist and practicing for 16 years as a radiation oncologist, I also was in healthcare design and healthcare leadership, and specifically designed, launched, and led Kaiser Permanente's cancer service line for the Northwest region of the US. And in doing that design work, it's very important to have patients at the table and caregivers who are receiving the care. And so as we were designing this new model for end-to-end care within our cancer service line, we had patient advisors as part of our team. And I remember meeting with them one day, and we were talking about survivorship. And in cancer, we just think of survivorship as the name for the care that we give to patients once they finish all active treatment. Then they're, you know, in this realm where we're not actively treating the cancer, but we're managing side effects and complications associated with the treatment, and also helping them live better after cancer is the idea. But as we were talking about this program, one of the patients was like, "I hate that word." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And it turned out that the word survivor was such a trigger for her. And so in that TED talk, I talk about how this term even came onto my radar. I mean, as a doctor and as an oncologist, we just use it. We don't even think about it. It's just the term that we use to describe people who have cancer. And I had no idea that it could be offensive and really upsetting. And so it started with that conversation with her and this group of patient advisors. And then ultimately, I collaborated with some colleagues who are around the country and looked at how could we study this? How could we get a better sense of how people feel about this term in the cancer space? And we did a pilot study with SMART patients, which was a large group of different kinds of cancer. And then ultimately our formal study was done through the Army of Women, which is women with breast cancer. And so in that talk, I talk about, you know, these are things we don't even think about. Most of us are just kind of going along and using the language that is in the vernacular of, you know, medical care or treatment, and having no idea the ramification of those words that we're using. And through studying that term, and then it opened my eyes to this whole world of language and healing in general. And so the rest of the talk, I talk about not only the term survivor, but this battle language that we use. And, you know, there's a reason why battle language can be effective. Like, say they're talking about the war on cancer and, you know, the moonshot, and they're trying to get support and, you know, people excited or mad or whatever. It's good at evoking those emotions. But when you think about it, we're not marketing something when we're talking to people with cancer. Our goal is to heal them. And by using this language, it puts our patients in a trap where, you know, I've heard from many patients who are dying of their disease and no fault of their own, but they feel like a failure because they're giving up the fight or losing the battle, like all this language that we just don't even think about it. And really this talk, what was so beautiful for me is it opened my eyes. And then in the process of that, I ended up experiencing cancer in a much more personal way because my mom was diagnosed with cancer 3 weeks after I was given the TED talk and was preparing for it. And so I was able to see the other side of this. You know, I knew as a provider that the language was important, but then when I was supporting my mom, it all came full circle, and I could really see how shifting our perspective and talking to people about language is a powerful way for us to heal and support each other and support, you know, our patients.
Yeah, I love listening to this because it's educating me on, you know, something where, you know, I've spent 30 years in healthcare, and, you know, I'm at this moment starting to retrain my brain on how I actually think about cancer. Just from watching your 15-minute TED talk, and now getting an opportunity to speak with you. You know, one of the things that you said, and it was such a profound statement in that talk, was the way that a survivor is defined in the medical journal is from the date of their diagnosis until they pass. So from the date of inception, right, of a disease, or the first date that you're told you have cancer, until the day you pass away, you're a survivor, even while you're going through active treatment. And, you know, to me, that was kind of, it was kind of a shock to me to really hear that definition. But you have taken a different approach than maybe what I'm used to, coming from the large healthcare systems and the mainstream. You talk about, as you said with the vernacular a moment ago, you know, talking about battling, talking about fighting, you know, it invokes all of these feelings, right? And it may potentially get your body reacting in a negative way. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely. So our bodies respond to our emotions, and language is a way of evoking emotions. And so if we're putting someone into an emotion of like fight or battle, or, you know, there's like this scarcity associated with it, it's actually activating their sympathetic nervous system, which is the exact opposite of what we do. You know, there's data in cardiovascular disease that shows the balance between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system is absolutely important in healing. And that when we're using this kind of language, we're pushing people into a sympathetic response of fight or flight. And really what we're wanting to do is to calm the nervous system. We want to help get people out of the sympathetic nervous system, activate their vagus nerve so that they can activate the parasympathetic system, which is basically rest, digest, and repair, right? We want people repairing when we're dealing with cancer. And so the language that we use has a physiologic effect on ourselves and also the people around us. And the one thing that's interesting is when we use this language in the presence of someone else. So say, you know, you mean well and you're like, we're going to fight this, you know, to the end, or we're going to, you know, give it all we got. And the person on the other side is not sure how they feel about it yet. That actually stresses them out because they're like, what if I don't want to fight? Or what if I, you know, and it just, we don't even, I think part of it comes from, it's hard to know the right thing to say. When someone we love is scared and dealing with a life-threatening illness, we want to be supportive, and yet we feel like we lack the tools. And I say this as a professional who's taking care of thousands of cancer patients at this point in my life. When someone is diagnosed with cancer, I know that sometimes I have trouble finding the right word. So I know that people who don't deal with this day in and day out really want to be supportive. They want to help their loved ones. But we sometimes just say things because we've seen them said, and it seems like it's well accepted, but then not realizing, okay, there are actually implications. And this is one of the things that I say in the talk, it's okay to not know. And it's okay to ask, you know, how can I best support you? What language feels most supportive for you? Because some people actually are motivated by that idea of fighting, and they like that gets them pumped up and they're, you know, into it. And for them, it makes absolute sense. And then for someone else, it could be the opposite, where it stresses them. And so I think we want to just acknowledge that it's okay not to know what to say, and to say, you know what, I love you, and I'm here no matter what you're going through. And I want to be, you know, I want to be a positive support for this experience. And please tell me how I can best support you. You know, if there are things that I say that are upsetting, tell me, because I want to adjust it. And I think just that, showing people that you love them and that you care and that you want to be there, and you don't know what the right way is to do it, is freeing, I think, for everyone. So I just encourage people to be curious and open in their communication.
Let me ask you this question. And I love everything that you're saying. And this is for my own edification, and hopefully some of my listeners are thinking the same thing. Does it tend to matter, the language that you use, between somebody, let's say a pediatric who's diagnosed with cancer, and a parent, right? As a parent, you're a parent, you know, you think to yourself, I've got to fight, right? My child has to fight. They have to do everything they can, as opposed to somebody who is of advanced age, right? Somebody in their 70s or 80s who's diagnosed with whatever the type of cancer may be, where It's more of, hey, I'm here to support you because you've gone through your life. You know how you feel. You know what you're willing to take on. Like, for example, my father-in-law, the last several days that he was with us, he called us all into his room at the hospital, but he did it for each one of his kids and their families. So when it was my wife, who's the baby, when it was her turn to go in and talk to Pop, it was myself, our three kids, and we went in and he said, listen, you know, and this is a true story. He said, I know you want me to fight. He said, but I'm tired now. And that's not what I want. And I don't want to have to take these medications that don't make me feel right. I don't want to have to undergo these treatments that are painful. I don't want to be a burden to my wife any longer. You know, and as someone who grew up without a father, you know, my wife's father really was my dad for, you know, the majority of my adult life. And hearing that, you know, it angered me, right? Because, and I guess it was selfish of me, but it angered me because I'm thinking to myself, how could you not want to be here anymore? You've got grandchildren, great grandchildren, your own children. I mean, where is it from the perspective of a family member who's going through the course with the patient? I mean, I'm not going through what my father-in-law is going through. I wasn't feeling what he was feeling. I didn't go through what my grandmother was going through or what she was feeling, but I was going through it in my own way. I had my own journey. Is there a right or wrong way to respond to somebody who doesn't have the same mindset as you?
Yeah, no, I think this is an amazing question because this is the crux of it, that we all have different values. We all have different lenses that we see the world through, and we need to check ourselves at the door. And like when I walk into the room with a patient, I have to check what I think is best because I'm entering into the space of someone else who needs me to be their best advocate for what is best for them. And as like, I think at a lot of times oncologists will say, well, I know because I've got all this, you know, information and all this data, and I know what's best for you. But the truth is that human beings are not numbers. We're not taking, you know, a number in statistics and plugging it in being like, this is your best outcome. Your father-in-law actually gave you a beautiful gift because he had clarity. And I think what becomes difficult is it's difficult when people have clarity and you disagree, right? Your own feelings. And you have to think about this. Cancer is not just something that affects one person. It affects an entire family and ecosystem. And so everyone who is connected to that person who has become sick is affected. And we have to really recognize our own biases when we come into the space of supporting someone else and recognizing that, you know, you're worried about losing this father figure. You're worried about your wife losing her father. You're worried about your children losing their grandchildren. You have a lot of vested reasons for wanting to have him stay around. And he has very clear reasons for why he's lived a good life and he doesn't want to prolong his life and experience additional suffering. And so just recognizing that both of those things are true, both of those things are valid. And it's a matter of, like in any relationship, communicating, you know, I think this is the thing, is it's never wrong to communicate your truth and to say to someone, you know, wow, it is really hard for me to hear you say that because I can't imagine you not being here. And maybe that's selfish because it's like, you know, I don't want to lose you, but I also hear what you're saying. And I want you to know that I want to support you because you're the one who's experiencing this illness. And I think it just, all of this comes down to being open and vulnerable. And a lot of times we maybe feel mixed up inside and that we can't tease it apart. But I think one of the things, and I talk about this on my podcast, is that in order to be a good caregiver for someone who's sick, like, for example, someone with cancer, you have to have your own support system and you have to be looking and creating awareness around your triggers so that you're not triggered and then causing more pain for them. And so this, what's beautiful is there's so much growth that can happen for everyone in a scenario like this. You know, clearly the person who's experienced an illness is growing and learning things about themselves, but all of us who are around someone, if we pay attention, it can help us gain more compassion, you know, more self-awareness of our own biases, our own triggers. And so I this is why I love cancer, is because it is messy, it's complicated, it's real. Like when people are sick with cancer, life gets real. And I love being in that space because there's so much beauty that can come out of that.
Yeah, that's incredible. You know, so for my listeners that, you know, they know what an oncologist is, but what is an integrated oncologist for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So in my career as a radiation oncologist and then as a healthcare leader, I love taking care of patients. And I love the intimacy that is in this space of dealing with people who are facing life-threatening illness like cancer. But what I was really frustrated with was that I felt like we did a good job of killing the cancer cells, but we didn't do a great job of telling patients, well, why did you get sick in the first place? How can we prevent you from getting sick again? Or going upstream and saying, how do we help people not get sick in the first place? And so an integrated approach to any illness, and specifically in my case, cancer, is looking at the person as a whole and realizing that as human beings, we're not like a machine. And actually Western medicine is designed a little bit like that. Like we're a machine, we have parts that can be replaced, or, you know, if one thing's wrong, you just replace that or you give it some medications to fix it. But the truth is that we are affected, our physical body is affected by our emotional health and well-being, as well as the thoughts that we have. And then from a spiritual perspective, when I speak of spirituality, it's like who we are at our core. You know, those are things that come up for people when they get sick and they face life-threatening illness or they face their own death, and really addressing that spiritual aspect of who you are at your core and how do you get aligned with that. And then the aspect of divine healing. You know, we all have heard stories of people who cure themselves. And I'm telling you, as I've stepped away from like my traditional practice and looked into the data, it's like, why are we not looking at more of this and incorporating more of these things where people are making themselves better without really aggressive treatment? And so this kind of practice incorporates all the different pieces that can help someone heal. And really, I break it down into two aspects of my practice. The first is people who are pursuing conventional therapy. So people like I would have seen in my practice as a radiation oncologist, or they're having surgery or they're having chemotherapy. There are things that we can do to support those patients emotionally, mentally, spiritually, and physically to help them get better results with the treatment that they're receiving. And you think about this like athletes. So I was a professional athlete before I went to medical school. And when I was at the Olympic Training Center, I had sports psychologists working with me every day on how do I use my mind to control my body and to get the outcomes that I want. And this is the same in medicine. We just don't talk about it like that. But part of my practice is treatment performance. How do I help patients, number one, make decisions that they feel very comfortable with? So whenever they're going to do a treatment, they are bought in, they know why they're doing it, they understand the risks and the benefits, and they're ready to go so that we have nothing that's kind of hindering their performance. And then the...
It's all good. It's all good. So for our listeners, she's getting a radiator replaced in her building. So the little bit of banging in the background is all right. Listen, you should hear some of the things that go on sometimes on this podcast. So a little banging on a radiator is not going to hurt anybody.
Yeah, thank you. So it's really that first part of my practice, which I didn't totally anticipate, is really bridging this gap between, you know, performance and getting better outcomes with people's treatment. So using their mind, calming their nervous system, getting them, like, you know, reducing the inflammation in their body so their bodies are able to heal better. That's one part of my practice. And then the other part of my practice is really looking at what are the other components that impact our physical health. And one of the things that I've become fascinated with over the past several years is the impact of emotions and emotional trauma and stress on our physical bodies. And there is significant data showing that people who have emotional trauma, like there's a study called the ACE study. And the ACE study, ACE stands for adverse childhood events. And basically what this study shows is that children who have higher number of ACEs, and an ACE or an adverse childhood event could be abuse. It could be physical abuse. It could be sexual abuse. It could be neglect. It could be a parent who has an addiction. It could be losing a parent. So there's all these different traumatic events that a child could experience. And what they found was they followed these children, they counted the number of ACEs that they had, and what they found was the higher the ACE score, the higher the risk of cardiovascular disease,
wow,
cancer, COPD, depression, substance abuse. I mean, we kind of expect the depression and substance abuse. And the other thing to note is that it's not like, a you know, trauma leads to depression and substance abuse, and then they get illness. Like if you take away the bad habits and stuff that may be caused by having a traumatic childhood, these children still have higher risk of illness. And then also, if you look at the radical remission data, which is a body of literature that was compiled by Kelly Turner, who's a PhD, and she studies people who cure their illness without conventional treatment that you would expect to result in a cure. Two of the things that those people do are emotional healing. So healing past traumas, and then also managing their emotions to get into more of a state of joy and peace. And so as I'm looking at this, I'm like, we need to teach people, and especially in the world that we're living in today, look at what's going on with Israel. We are all impacted by what we're seeing on the news and what's happening. And there's so much negativity that if we don't know how that impacts us, we can end up absorbing all of that and it can make you physically sick. And so that is now a big part of my practice, is really teaching about the importance of emotional health.
That's so you've hit on a number of things. The first thing I want to go back to for a minute, because you kind of snuck that in on me. You were an Olympic athlete.
I trained at the Olympic Training Center. I was a triathlete. It happened all very fast, and I ended up within like my third triathlon race. I was just doing it because I was a college athlete. I was a springboard diver, and I had an injury with my sinuses where the doctor was like, you can't dive. My coach said, you have to stay in shape. And my boyfriend was a triathlete. And so I started doing triathlons, and I was very fast and made the national team after my third race, moved to the Olympic Training Center. It was literally like a whirlwind. It was almost too much for me, but there was so much that I was exposed to during that time that made me realize these are principles you can apply really in any area of your life. And it's so interesting that we don't apply it in healing.
You know, it's incredible. So, you know, you touched on spirituality, you know, and on my show, I love to broach the faith aspect of things, because irrespective of whether you go and get in your car and drive a mile or 10 miles to a building with a bunch of people for, you know, the community experience and to get the message from, you know, a leader, a pastor, a reverend, a priest, a rabbi, a cleric, whoever it may be, or whether you take your walk on your own, getting into the book, getting into whatever it is that, you know, your religion, you know, produces for you. You know, at what point, let me ask you this, Have you always been a woman of faith? Have you always been a spiritual person, or did you find yourself on a journey that led you to your faith and to your spirituality to be able to have these heartfelt, meaningful conversations with your patients?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. And I would say I've always been spiritual. I've always known there was something more, but I was raised in a very strict Catholic tradition that I didn't jive with because I didn't like the hypocrisy that I was seeing of like, okay, do this. And then, but if you go, you know, just go say your forgiveness or whatever, your, you know, confession, yep, and then everything's absolved. And I just didn't like that. It didn't feel integral, like that people said and did what they did.
And then so you're back to the same things that you were doing on Monday that led you to confessional on Sunday. I got you. I'm with you. We're there.
Yeah. So I was, you know, leery of organized religion since I was young, since I was about 15. And, but my whole entry into oncology and then my whole career has been really informed by being around people who are dying. And the way I ended up going to medical school was I was a neuroscience after I did my racing for like, I was out of school for like 9 months. And then when I decided to go back to school, I'm like, okay, I was a neuroscience major. And I was like, I either could do research or go into medicine. You know, that was naive. I could probably do anything with a career with a degree in neuroscience. But at the time, I didn't know that. And so my mom was like, well, you really want to have children. So I don't know if you want to be a doctor. And she was a nurse. And she was like, I'm just not sure as a woman who wants to have children that this is a great path. And so I said, okay, great. Well, what would I hate about medicine? And I was like, well, I definitely don't want to deal with people dying. I'd never experienced death from anyone in my family or loved ones. And so I decided to volunteer at hospice because I was going to cross medicine off my list. And as you can see, that story did not turn out that way. But what happened was, as I spent time with people who were dying, I learned things about life that I had never heard in 20 years. You know, I was young, 20 years old, thought the world revolved around me. And all of a sudden I saw these people who were sharing with me. And basically I was a stranger because I was just a volunteer at this hospice, but they were sharing the most profound things with me about what they wish they had known, what they wish they had done, what their regrets were, what the things they would do again. And I was like, this was where I wanted to be. These were the people that I wanted to spend my time around. I love the intimacy of that. And that's really why I ended up in oncology in the first place. And what's interesting is I had an interview with an oncologist when I was interviewing for medical school. It was, you know, you interview with all these different attending doctors at the med schools that you interview with. And Harvard was the only school that put me with an oncologist. So I got to actually interview him with an oncologist. And I was so excited to meet this man because I thought for sure he was going to understand why I wanted to go into oncology. But during that interview, he said to me, you know, you see on your personal statement that you want to be an oncologist. And I'm just wondering why. And I explained this experience around being with people who were dying and the intimacy and the lessons that I would learned and how just profound it was. And I said, I want to spend my life and career around that. Like, I want more of that in my life. And what was interesting at the time, and now I think there's truth to it and I see it, but he said, you know, that's not a good reason to become an oncologist. He said, if you just want to spend time with people who have cancer or dying, you could be a social worker, you could be a nurse, but in order to be a doctor, you need to love the science. And I was devastated because I was never like a science person. I could do the science, but that's not what drove me. And so after that conversation, I left that interview just like tears streaming down my face, like, oh my gosh, my reason for wanting to be a doctor is not a good one. And so I shoved that in my backpack and I never said it again to anyone, which now in retrospect, I'm like, I realized what he was trying to say, which is true. And is part of why I've transitioned out of, you know, traditional medicine. But all of this comes for full circle back to death, really, as an advisor for spirituality. For me, is that the reason why I ultimately left my position of radiation oncology was because in 2020, I had an experience that's similar to a near-death experience. except that it happens to healthcare providers who are at the scene of someone else who dies. And they, the healthcare provider, can experience what the soul of the person who is dying experiences.
Wow.
And that happened to me in the fall of 2020. And I've never been the same after that, because number one, I saw and felt whatever is on the other side, whatever we describe as someone transitions, it is pure love. It is the most beautiful place I've ever been. And it's indescribable. And I know there's nothing to worry about, that I know when I leave here, when I leave this body, it's literally just shedding this body, but then my soul goes on, and wherever I'm going is amazing. But the other thing that I learned in that experience, or actually two more things, one of them was that what I'm going to be held accountable to is not whether I was successful and I made a ton of money and whether I did what everyone wanted me to do and I was the good doctor and all this stuff. It was no. What I'm going to be held accountable to is, did I live a life that was authentic to me, who I am, not what I was taught to be? And then the third thing is that I realized that frequency, healing relates to frequency. And this kind of ties into the whole thing of emotions. And since then, I've done a lot of study on, David Hawkins is a MD, PhD, who did a lot of research in the area of frequency and emotions and how the frequency of those emotions affect the body. But anyway, when I came back from that, I had known something was wrong in Western medicine. I was like, I just had this feeling, like, I was like, we're not going upstream. We're not really helping people. But after that event, I was like, this is not who I am. This is not what I'm supposed to be doing. And I need to be true to who I am. But I didn't know what that looked like. I didn't even know what integrative oncologists did. I didn't know. All I knew was I need to leave this so that I can figure out what I'm supposed to be doing. And I knew that that was like my ultimate task in this life. But the challenge came in that my husband was like, what are you talking about? You make $500,000 a year. You're great at your job. You're helping people. Why would your job is easy for you? You work 4 days a week. Why would you ever leave? And so it took me a couple years to work through that process and finally say to my husband, I said, you know, I understand that you don't understand why I need to do this. But the other thing is that I cannot, when I leave here, you're not going with me. And I can't point at you and say, I stayed because my family needed that. I'm going to be accountable to myself. And so I will do anything for you except betray myself, you know? And so it makes me emotional because it was a really hard path to make that decision. But once I finally left, and then I took a year off to heal and did, you know, started diving into like, what is it that really helps people heal? I absolutely know I'm in the right place, you know, and this is what I meant to do.
You know, listen, we all take our walk in life. We all have to be comfortable that when we look in the mirror and we see what's staring back at us, that we're okay with that. And in life, sometimes, you know, being fulfilled, you know, means we're fulfilled because we're giving of ourselves. We're giving back to those who are in need. You know, one of the things that I love, and I'm so blessed with what I get to do, both in my real job and, you know, in my podcast life, because I get to talk to people, and to me, I would put you into the same category as any of the philanthropists that I talk to. And philanthropy isn't just about how much money do you give, how many checks do you write. It's about what you give back to those who are less fortunate. So, you know, I look at you and I think to myself, man, you fit right into the discussions with the Marcus Pollards and the Ryan Blisses and the Randy Couture's, and, you know, the list goes on and on of those who have been able to achieve financial success recognition for a job well done. But when they step away from professional sports, or they step away from whatever their career was, and in your case, you stepped away from a very comfortable situation, making a very good living, because it wasn't fulfilling. And you said, I've got to give something back that's more than just this traditional Western medicine approach. And that leads me to a question. And I can tell how passionate you are. And I can tell that, you know, your journey that you took for that year, you know, you still carry some of the weight of that with you, right? And anytime, listen, I've been with my wife for more than two decades, and you know, I get it. I understand. You know, she and I took our own walk at one point, probably, I think it was 8 years into the marriage, and we had to kind of pause and collect ourselves and figure out, hey, how do we get this thing back on track? And how do we continue to support each other? And how do we recognize that, you know, each of our individual dreams, each of our individual desires on what we want to do to make us feel more fulfilled, how do we support each other to get there? Fortunately for Jill and I, we were able to figure that out and to get back on track. Unfortunately, sometimes you don't get back on track, and you know, you get an opportunity to, you know, look back a year later, 5 years later, 10 years later, and you think to yourself, as hard of a decision as that was, it was the best thing that I could have done. And my question that I have for you, because we're talking about emotional support, we're talking about therapeutic support, we're talking about all of these things that culminate into helping somebody heal, right? I'm done using the term fight. I'm done using the term battle. My mind has now gone to a place of, how do you help somebody heal? Do you get pushback from other oncologists that look at you and say, Katie, what are you doing? You're turning your back on science, or you're turning your back on Western medicine. You know, you're a quack. You've gone off the deep end, woman. What have you done? I mean, I have to think, knowing medicine the way that I do, that there had to be some of this pushback.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that if my colleagues are saying that, they're not saying it directly to me. So, but I know that some of them are thinking that, like, why? And especially, it's funny, if I talk to doctors from other specialties, they're like, well, if you're a rad onc and you left, then there's really problems in medicine, because radiation oncologists, we have generally a pretty good lifestyle. We make a lot of money. We usually work like 8 to 5. It's not like a surgeon who's in the hospital at 5 in the morning, or medical oncologists who are spending the night in the hospital. So I know that there is probably that sentiment. But the other thing is this, is that, and this is part of why I'm sharing my journey of leaving medicine, and this is what you originally saw some of my posts on LinkedIn, is that I think showing the process, and sometimes people, like, they go through this like really, really messy process, and then they publish a book and they're like, it's amazing out here, you know, and they only show the end product. But I really believe in showing what it's really like to move through a massive transformation like that. And that's part of why I've been sharing as I'm going. Of course, I need to do a certain amount of healing before I'm ready to share. Otherwise, I'm an emotional mess and can't share from a place of power. Yep. But this is part of the reason why I'm intentionally sharing my story, because I know there are other doctors that feel this same way. And more than anything, that's what I hear from people, is like, you know, good for you. And now I've had several other colleagues who were at my same organization who've taken a similar path and left. And not that I want doctors to leave medicine, because I think we're going to have a problem, but I think we're in crisis. And I think that these good doctors, when you see doctors who are really good at what they do and at the top of their field stepping away, it makes you ask a question. And that's one of the things that I didn't expect, but several people have pointed out to me, hey, do you wonder how this makes your colleagues feel? Because you were at, you know, when I left the, or when I decided to leave, so in September of 2020, right before that shared death experience had happened, I had been nominated for the national medical director for all of cancer services within Kaiser Permanente. So I was one of six doctors who had been nominated for this position, the only radiation oncologist. All of them were medical oncologists, which are usually the, you know, leaders for these programs. And I made it all the way to the number two spot. So I was at the top of my game, top of my career, when I decided to step off. And that gets my colleagues' attention because I've always been a forward thinker. I've always been like a visionary at looking like, how can we do this better? And then to have someone like that who just walks away is like, whoa. You know, so it's true. Yeah. I think some of them think I'm crazy. And then some of them are thinking like, oh gosh, like, what does that mean? You know, why is someone like that stepping out?
To do what she did is probably what a lot of them are thinking. You know, listen, the business of medicine has forever changed physicians' outlook, right? Because when you put paper above patient care, when you put profits above patient care, your outcomes are going to diminish, right? Your outcomes for health of the patient, well-being of the patient, your own satisfaction. I mean, I have so many physicians that I've worked with and represented going through audit appeals, going through federal, civil, and criminal trials, and going through peer reviews and composite board medical, you know, exam, interviews. And, you know, many of them get to the point and they're like, you know what, Sean, I'm not joking. I'm done. I'd rather go work at Home Depot and feel more fulfilled than what I feel right now as having to justify my clinical judgment to people who are MBAs or maybe not even MBAs. So, you know, I asked the question about how many of them are pushing back on you, but, you know, the number of physicians walking away is astounding. And I agree with you. We're already in a crisis. I mean, when you have medical schools that no longer require students to take the MCATs, you know there's a problem. So, last question that I have for you, and I want to make sure that in the podcast description that I make sure I direct people to your website, to the wonderful things that you're doing for your patients. You've become an entrepreneur, and actually, if I'm not mistaken, you've been an entrepreneur dating back probably to like 2015, 2016, if memory serves correctly, when you were smart enough and had the awareness to listen to your patients that were going through radiation treatment and complaining about the sensitivity to, you know, certain areas of their body, that you said, hey, I have a solution. What did you do?
Yeah. So this, what you're talking about is I had launched a line of bras for women who have sensitive skin from radiation. Although I never planned to be an inventor. So I have a patent on a product. I never intentionally set out to do that or to launch a product or to launch a company, but I was frustrated because I was seeing my patients and I had been taught that women who have radiation for breast cancer, they're going to get a sunburn on their skin, but just tell them to go braless because a bra is going to be really painful. And I didn't think that I had been taught to this by male attendings, because all the men who were taking care of breast cancer at my institution when I was training were men. And so I just took that and I was like, okay, this is what I was taught in residency. And so I started telling patients that. And like my patients are like, Dr. Deming, like, you're a woman. Don't you know you can't go braless? And especially my breasts are swollen and they're irritated. This is not helping me. And so then I was like, well, there must be products. There's all these bras for women with breast cancer. The surgeons refer patients. So then I did a little like reconnaissance session where I went into Nordstrom and pretended like I was going to have a lumpectomy and radiation and asked the woman to show me what bras are available for women who are, you know, having radiation for breast cancer. And the experience was horrible. So I was taken past all the beautiful lingerie and the, you know, on the floor that I normally would shop in. I was taken into a back room and then brought all of these things in this medical packaging that looked like total utilitarian, like something I would never want to put on my body. The women on the, you know, photos on the branding were like, you know, no hair, no eyebrows, like clearly looked sick.
Oh my God.
And so I was like a doctor. I was just doing like research and all of a sudden I felt horrible about myself. And I'm like, oh, I got to put these things on. And then I put them on and they were all wrong. Like totally not for women with sensitive skin. They're good for compression, like women who have had a mastectomy and need compression. So anyway, I left there and I was like, I'm never sending my patients there. And I just started experimenting with patients, like trying to figure out how can I make their bras more comfortable. And I was cutting out pieces of cotton and I was flipping camisoles inside out. Oh, you name it, I did it. It was stupid. I'm like, I have a $5 million machine that can protect your heart from, you know, the radiation with breast cancer, but I can't find you a comfortable bra. So I did this for years until I was like, you know what, this is so dumb. Like someone needs to do something. And so ultimately I created a product and I initially licensed it to another company because I didn't want to run an apparel company. And ultimately my products did better than their products. So then they stole my design. So then I had to sue them just to get my rights back. And I then launched my own company and I did that. But I just actually closed that down this summer because I knew with my practice, I wanted all of my attention being on this new direction. And so my line of bras now is closed. But yeah, it was just seeing a need and wanting my patients to have not only something that felt good against their skin that their doctor would want them to wear, but that they would say, I want to wear this because it makes me look beautiful. You know, so it's just, and this is kind of, this fits into my whole career. I've very much recognized that it's not only important what we do to people, it's how we make them feel. That's the healing.
That's awesome. Well, as far as the bra company is concerned, maybe you should reach out to Damon Johns and see if it's something that he wants to pick up and run forward with. That guy, I think he's got the apparel thing down pretty well, and I know he loves taking on these kind of challenges. So maybe a conversation down the road. Listen, Katie, it has been such an honor and such a privilege to be able to spend time with you and to listen to and learn that there is a different approach. There's what, dare I say, for me, is now a better approach to when I encounter somebody that's dealing with, you know, going through the treatment process of cancer, that I am a support mechanism for them. I'm not their rah-rah, hey, let's get rowdy and let's fight this thing and let's go to war and let's do battle because we want to block the cortisol. We want to stop the endorphins and the enkephrins and all of these bad things that could promote non-healing or could prevent healing, if you will, and more or less turn my eye to how can I best support you? What can I do to make you feel more comfortable and to, you know, feel like if you need a sounding board, you've got somebody because you're the one going through this. I'm just along for the journey.
I love that.
All right.
Well, and also never underestimate your love is enough. You know, like just going through an experience with any kind of illness and knowing that the people around you love you unconditionally is beautiful. You know, that's, I think, one of the most powerful things that you can do is just express, I love you and I'm here. And I may not know how to best support you, but I'm willing to learn and do that in the way that feels the most uplifting to you. I think there's something so powerful in that.
That's such a great message. And, you know, to all of my listeners, as I said before we got started onto this podcast today, I think this almost hour discussion with Dr. Deming is going to, like it has for me, and I hope it does, it's going to change your perspective on things. It's going to help you to better understand how to not sympathize with somebody, but to empathize with them as they take their journey towards healing. And I agree. I think at some point we have to start looking outside of just traditional Western medicine, and we have to look at an integrated approach, which is what Dr. Deming is talking about, which is, you know, getting up off that couch, not living a sedentary lifestyle, blocking out the noise, the chaos, the things that bring anxiety, anger, frustration into your life. Being mindful of the foods that you're putting into your body, taking the time to take that spiritual walk or that walk of faith with whoever you pray to. And for me, I can tell you what has done the most wonderful thing in my life. I shut off the news. I refuse to watch CNN or Fox or MSNBC or any of that, because every day it's just painful. So for those of you that are not dealing with someone going through cancer, but somebody who does have another life-altering illness, cardiovascular disease, or any other type of disease process, I believe that the things we've talked about on this podcast today with Dr. Deming, those will have as much of a positive benefit to those disease processes as it does to the patients going through their journey of cancer and finding how best to heal. So I want to thank my special guest today, Dr. Katie Deming, for taking time out of her crazy busy schedule to sit down and spend some time with me and with my followers, my guests, to this podcast each and every single week. I'll be back next week with another absolutely fantastic podcast. I can't wait to introduce you to my next special guest. Until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media at The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.